Not long after, Bill Richards and Mary Casamano, a social worker and school guidance counselor Richards recruited to help him guide psychedelic sessions, administered the first legal dose of psilocybin to an American in 22 years. In the years since, the Hopkins team has conducted more than 300 psilocybin sessions, working in a variety of populations, including healthy normals, long-term and novice meditators, cancer patients, smokers seeking to break their habit, and religious professionals. I was curious to get the volunteer's eye view of the experience from all these types, but especially from that first cohort of healthy normals, partly because they were participants in a study that would turn out to be historically important, and partly because I figured they would be the most like, well, me. What is it like to have a legally sanctioned, professionally guided, optimally comfortable, high-dose psilocybin experience? Yet the volunteers in the first experiments were not exactly like me, because at the time I doubt I would have read past interested in the spiritual life. There were no stone-cold atheists in the original group, and interviews with nearly a dozen of them suggested many, if not most of them, came into the study with spiritual leanings to one degree or another. There was an energy healer, a man who'd done the whole Iron John trip, a former Franciscan friar, and an herbalist. There was also a physicist with an interest in Zen and a philosophy professor with an interest in theology. Roland Griffiths acknowledged, "We were interested in a spiritual effect and were biasing the condition initially in that direction." That said, Griffiths went to great lengths in the design of the study to control for expectancy effects. In part, this owed to Griffiths' skepticism that a drug could occasion the same kind of mystical experience he had had in his meditation. "This is all truth to Bill," he told me, "and a hypothesis to me, so we needed to control for Bill's biases." All of the volunteers were hallucinogen naive, so had no idea what psilocybin felt like, and neither they nor their monitors knew in any given session whether they were getting psilocybin or a placebo, and whether that placebo was a sugar pill or any one of a half a dozen different psychoactive drugs. In fact, the placebo was Ritalin, and as it turned out, the monitors guessed wrong nearly a quarter of the time as to what was in the pill a volunteer had received. Even years after their experiences in the trials, the volunteers I spoke to recalled them in vivid detail and at considerable length. The interviews lasted hours. These people had big stories to tell. In several cases, these were the most meaningful experiences of their lives, and they clearly relished the opportunity to relive them for me in great detail, whether in person, by Skype, or on the telephone. The volunteers were also required to write a report of their experiences soon after they occurred, and all of the ones I interviewed were happy to share these reports, which made for strange and fascinating reading. Many of the volunteers I spoke to reported initial episodes of intense fear and anxiety before surrendering themselves to the experience, as the sitters encouraged them to do. The sitters work from a set of flight instructions prepared by Bill Richards, based on the hundreds of psychedelic journeys he has guided. The guides go over the instructions with the volunteers during the 8 hours of preparation all of them receive before commencing their journeys. The flight instructions advise guides to use mantras like, "Trust the trajectory," and TLO, "Trust, let go, be open." Some guides like to quote John Lennon, "Turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream." Volunteers are told they may experience the, quote, "death transcendence of your ego or everyday self," but this is, quote, "always followed by rebirth, return to the normative world of space and time. Safest way to return to normal is to entrust self unconditionally to the emerging experiences." Guides are instructed to remind volunteers they'll never be left alone and not to worry about the body while journeying because the guides are there to keep an eye on it. If you feel as if you are, quote, "dying, melting, dissolving, exploding, going crazy, etc., go ahead. Volunteers are quizzed. If you see a door, what do you do? If you see a staircase, what do? Open it and climb up it are, of course, the right answers. This careful preparation means that a certain expectancy effect is probably unavoidable. After all, the researchers are preparing people for a major experience involving death and rebirth and holding the potential for transformation. It would be irresponsible not to warn volunteers these things could happen, Griffiths pointed out when I asked if his volunteers were being primed for a certain kind of experience. One volunteer, the physicist, told me that the mystical experience questionnaire he filled out after every session also planted expectations. I longed to see some of the stuff hinted at in the questionnaire, he wrote after an underwhelming session, perhaps on the placebo. Seeing everything as alive and connected, meeting the void or some embodiment of deities and things like that. In this and so many other ways, it seems, the Hopkins psilocybin experience is the artifact not only of this powerful molecule, but also of the preparation and expectations of the volunteer, the skills and worldviews of the sitters, Bill Richards' flight instructions, the decor of the room, the inward focus encouraged by the eye shades and the music itself, much of which, to my ears, sounds notably religious. And, though they might not be pleased to hear it, the minds of the designers of the experiments. The sheer suggestibility of psychedelics is one of their defining characteristics. So in one sense, it is no wonder that so many of the first cohort of volunteers at Hopkins had powerful mystical experiences. The experiment was designed by three men intensely interested in mystical states of consciousness. And it is likewise no wonder that the European researchers I interviewed all failed to see as many instances of mystical experience in their subjects as the Americans did in theirs. And yet, for all the priming going on, the fact remains that the people who received a placebo simply didn't have the kinds of experiences that volunteer after volunteer described to me as the most meaningful or significant in their lives. Soon after a volunteer takes her pill from the little chalice, but before she feels any effects, Roland Griffiths will usually stop by the session room to wish her bon voyage. Griffiths often uses a particular metaphor that made an impression on many of the volunteers I spoke to. Think of yourself as an astronaut being blasted into outer space, Richard Boothby recalled him saying. Boothby is a philosophy professor who was in his early 50s when he volunteered at Hopkins. You're going way out there to take it all in and engage with whatever you find there, but you can be confident that we'll be here keeping an eye on things. Think of us as ground control. We've got you covered. For the astronaut being blasted into space, the shudder of liftoff and strain of escaping Earth's gravitational field can be wrenching, even terrifying. Several volunteers described trying to hold on for dear life as they felt their sense of self rapidly disintegrating. Brian Turner, who at the time of his journey was a 44-year-old physicist working for a military contractor with a security clearance, put it this way. I could feel my body dissolving, beginning with my feet, until it all disappeared but the left side of my jaw. It was really unpleasant. I could count only a few teeth left and the bottom part of my jaw. I knew that if that went away, I would be gone. Then I remembered what they told me, that whenever you encounter anything scary, go toward it. So instead of being afraid of dying, I got curious about what was going on. I was no longer trying to avoid dying. Instead of recoiling from the experience, I began to interrogate it. And with that, the whole situation dissolved into this pleasant, floaty feeling, and I became the music for a while. Soon after, he found himself, quote, in a large cave where all my past relationships were hanging down as icicles. The person who sat next to me in second grade, high school friends, my first girlfriend, all of them were there encased in ice. It was very cool. I thought about each of them in turn, remembering everything about our relationship. It was a review, something about the trajectory of my life. All these people had made me what I had become. Amy Charney, a nutritionist and herbalist in her 30s, came to Hopkins after a crisis. An avid runner, she had been studying forest ecology when she fell from a tree and shattered her ankle, ending both her running and her forestry careers. In the early moments of her journey, Amy was overcome by waves of guilt and fear. The visual I had was from the 1800s, and I was up on the stage. Two people next to me were slipping a noose around my neck while a crowd of people watched, cheering for my death. I felt drenched with guilt, just terrified. I was in a hell realm, and I remember Bill asking, "What's going on?" "I'm experiencing a lot of guilt," Bill replied. "That's a very common human experience, and with that, the whole image of being hanged, pixelated, and then just disappeared, to be replaced by this tremendous sensation of freedom and interconnectedness. This was huge for me. I saw that if I can name and admit a feeling, confess it to someone, it would let go. A little older and wiser, now I can do this for myself. Sometime later, Charney found herself flying around the world and through time, perched on the back of a bird. I was aware enough to know my body was on the couch, but I was leaving my body and experiencing these things firsthand. I found myself in a drumming circle with an indigenous tribe somewhere, and I was being healed, but was also being the healer. This was very profound for me. Not having that traditional lineage of a healer, I had always felt like I was a phony doing plant medicine, but this made me see I was connected to the plants and to people who use the plants, whether for rituals or psychedelics or salad. During a subsequent session, Charney reconnected with a boyfriend from her youth who had died in a car accident at 19. All of a sudden, there is a piece of fill living in my left shoulder. I've never had an experience like that, but it was so real. I don't know why he's yellow and lives in my left shoulder. What does that even mean? But I don't care. He's back with me. Such reconnections with the dead are not uncommon. Richard Boothby, whose 23-year-old son had committed suicide a year earlier after years of drug addiction, told me, "Oliver was more present to me now than he had ever been before." The supreme importance of surrendering to the experience, however frightening or bizarre, is stressed in the preparatory sessions and figures largely in many people's journeys and beyond. Boothby, the philosopher, took the advice to heart and found that he could use the idea as a kind of tool to shape the experience in real time. He wrote, "Early on, I began to perceive that the effects of the drug respond strikingly to my own subjective determination. If in response to the swelling intensity of the whole experience, I began to tense up with anxiety, the whole scene appears to tighten in some way. But if I then consciously remind myself to relax, to let myself go into the experience, the effect is dramatic. The space in which I seem to find myself, already enormous, suddenly yawns open even further, and the shapes that undulate before my eyes appear to explode with new and even more extravagant patterns. Over and over again, I had the overwhelming sense of infinity being multiplied by another infinity. I joked to my wife as she drove me home that I felt as if I had been repeatedly sucked into the asshole of God." Boothby had what sounds very much like a classic mystical experience, though he may be the first in the long line of Western mystics to enter the divine realm through that particular aperture. "At the depths of this delirium," he continued, "I conceived that I was either dying or, most bizarrely, I was already dead. All points of secure attachment to a trustworthy sense of reality had fallen away. Why not think that I am dead? And if this is dying, I thought, then so be it. How can I say no to this? At this point, at the greatest depth of the experience, I felt all my organizing categories of opposition, dreaming and wakefulness, life and death, inside and outside, self and other, collapse into each other. Reality appeared to fold in on itself, to implode in a kind of ecstatic catastrophe of logic. Yet in the midst of this hallucinatory hurricane, I was having a weird experience of ultra-sublimity. And I remember repeating to myself again and again, 'Nothing matters. Nothing matters anymore. I see the point. Nothing matters at all.' And then it was over. During the last few hours, reality began slowly, effortlessly to stitch itself back together," he recalls. "In sync with some particularly wowing choral music, I had an incredibly moving sense of triumphant reawakening, as if a new day were dawning after a long and harrowing night." At the same time I was interviewing Richard Boothby and his fellow volunteers, I was reading William James's account of mystical consciousness in the varieties of religious experience in the hope of orienting myself. And indeed, much of what James had to say helped me get my bearings amid the torrent of words and images I was collecting. James prefaced his discussion of mystical states of consciousness by admitting that, quote, "my own constitution shuts me out from their enjoyment almost entirely." Almost entirely. What James knows about mystical states was gleaned not just from his reading, but also from his own experiments with drugs, including nitrous oxide. Rather than attempt to define something as difficult to grab hold of as a mystical experience, James offers four marks by which we may recognize one. The first, and to his mind handiest, is ineffability. Quote, the subject of it immediately says that it defies expression, that no adequate report of its contents can be given in words. With the possible exception of Boothby, all the volunteers I spoke to at one point or another despaired of conveying the full force of what they had experienced, gamely though they tried. You had to be there was a regular refrain. The noetic quality is James's second mark, quote, mystical states seem to those who experience them to be also states of knowledge. They are illuminations, revelations full of significance and importance, and as a rule, they carry with them a curious sense of authority. For every volunteer I've interviewed, the experience yielded many more answers than questions. And curiously, for what is after all a drug experience, these answers had about them a remarkable sturdiness and durability. John Hayes, a psychotherapist in his 50s, who was one of the first volunteers at Hopkins, wrote that he felt like mysteries were being unveiled, and yet it all felt familiar, and more like I was being reminded of things I had already known. I had a sense of initiation into dimensions of existence most people never know exist, including the distinct sense that death was illusory, in the sense that it was a door we walk through into another plane of existence, that we're sprung from an eternity to which we will return. Which is true enough, I suppose, but to someone having a mystical experience, such an insight acquires the force of revealed truth. So many of the specific insights gleaned during the psychedelic journey exist on a knife edge poised between profundity and utter banality. Boothby, an intellectual with a highly developed sense of irony, struggled to put words to the deep truths about the essence of our humanity revealed to him during one of his psilocybin journeys. I have at times been almost embarrassed by them, as if they give voice to a cosmic vision of the triumph of love that one associates derisively with the platitudes of Hallmark cards. All the same, the basic insights afforded to me during the sessions still seem for the most part compelling. What was the philosophy professor's compelling insight? Love conquers all. James touches on the banality of these mystical insights, quote, that deepened sense of the significance of a maxim or formula which occasionally sweeps over one. I've heard that said all my life, we exclaim, but I never realized its full meaning until now. The mystical journey seems to offer a graduate education in the obvious. Yet people come out of the experience understanding these platitudes in a new way. What was merely known is now felt, takes on the authority of a deeply rooted conviction. And more often than not, that conviction concerns the supreme importance of love. Karen Sokol, a life coach and energy healer in her 50s, described an experience that, quote, changed everything and opened me profoundly. At the climax of her journey, she had an encounter with a god who called himself I Am. In its presence, she recalled, quote, every one of my chakras was exploding, and then there was this light. It was the pure light of love and divinity, and it was with me, and no words were needed. I was in the presence of this absolute, pure, divine love, and I was merging with it in this explosion of energy. Just talking about it, my fingers are getting electric. It sort of penetrated me. The core of our being, I now knew, is love. At the peak of the experience, I was literally holding the face of Osama bin Laden, looking into his eyes, feeling pure love from him and giving it to him. The core is not evil, it is love. I had the same experience with Hitler and then someone from North Korea. So I think we are divine. This is not intellectual. This is a core knowingness. I asked Sokol what made her so sure this wasn't a dream or drug-induced fantasy, a suggestion that proved no match for her noetic sense. This was no dream, she said. This was as real as you and I having this conversation. I wouldn't have understood it either if I hadn't had the direct experience. Now it is hardwired in my brain, so I can connect to it and do often. This last point James alludes to in his discussion of the third mark of mystical consciousness, which is transiency. For although the mystical state cannot be sustained for long, its traces persist and recur, and, quote, from one recurrence to another, it is susceptible of continuous development in what is felt as inner richness and importance. The fourth and last mark in James's typology is the essential passivity of the mystical experience. Quote, The mystic feels as if his own will were in abeyance, and indeed sometimes as if he were grasped and held by a superior power. This sense of having temporarily surrendered to a superior force often leaves the person feeling as if he or she had been permanently transformed. For most of the Hopkins volunteers I interviewed, their psilocybin journey had taken place 10 or 15 years earlier, and yet their effects were still keenly felt, in some cases on a daily basis. Psilocybin awakened my loving compassion and gratitude in a way I had never experienced before, a psychologist who asked not to be named told me when I asked her about lasting effects. Trust, letting go, openness, and being were the touchstones of the experience for me. Now I know these things instead of just believing. She had turned Bill Richards' flight instructions into a manual for living. Richard Boothby did much the same thing, converting his insight about letting go into a kind of ethic. During my session, this art of relaxation itself became the basis of an immense revelation, as it suddenly appeared to me that something in the spirit of this relaxation, something in the achievement of a perfect trusting and loving openness of spirit, is the very essence and purpose of life. Our task in life consists precisely in a form of letting go of fear and expectations, an attempt to purely give oneself to the impact of the present. John Hayes, the psychotherapist, emerged with, quote, his sense of the concrete destabilized, replaced by a conviction that there's a reality beneath the reality of ordinary perceptions. It informed my cosmology that there is a world beyond this one. Hayes particularly recommends the experience to people in middle age for whom, as Carl Jung suggested, experience of the numinous can help them negotiate the second half of their lives. Hayes added, I would not recommend it to young people. Charney's journey at Hopkins solidified her commitment to herbal medicine. She now works for a supplement maker in Northern California. It also confirmed her in a decision to divorce her husband. Quote, everything was now so clear to me. I came out of the session and my husband was late to pick me up. I realized this is the theme with us. We're just really different people. I just got my ass kicked today and I needed him to be on time. She broke the news to him in the car going home and has not looked back. To listen to these people describe the changes in their lives inspired by their psilocybin journeys is to wonder if the Hopkins session room isn't a kind of human transformation factory, as Mary Casamano, the guide who has probably spent more time there than anyone else, described it to me. From now on, one volunteer told me, I think of my life as before and after psilocybin. Soon after his psilocybin experience, Brian Turner, the physicist, quit his job with the military contractor and moved to Colorado to study Zen. He had had a meditation practice before psilocybin, but, quote, now I had the motivation because I had tasted the destination. He was willing to do the hard work of Zen now that he had gotten a preview of the new modes of consciousness it could make available to him. Turner is now an ordained Zen monk, yet he is also still a physicist working for a company that makes helium neon lasers. I asked him if he felt any tension between his science and his spiritual practice. I don't feel there's a contradiction, he told me. Yet what happened at Hopkins has influenced my physics. I realize there are just some domains that science will not penetrate. Science can bring you to the Big Bang, but it can't take you beyond it. You need a different kind of apparatus to peer into that. These anecdotal reports of personal transformation found strong support in a follow-up study done on the first groups of healthy normals studied at Hopkins. Catherine McLean, a psychologist on the Hopkins team, crunched the survey data produced by 52 volunteers, including follow-up interviews with friends and family members they had designated, and discovered that in many cases the psilocybin experience had led to lasting changes in their personalities. Specifically, those volunteers who had complete mystical experiences, as determined by their scores on the Pankey Richards Mystical Experience Questionnaire, showed, in addition to lasting improvements in well-being, long-term increases in the personality trait of openness to experience. One of the five traits psychologists use to assess personality, the other four are conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism, openness encompasses, aesthetic appreciation and sensitivity, fantasy and imagination, as well as tolerance of others' viewpoints and values. It also predicts creativity in both the arts and the sciences, as well as, presumably, a willingness to entertain ideas at odds with those of current science. Such pronounced and lasting changes in the personalities of adults are rare. Yet not all these shifts in the direction of greater openness were confined to the volunteers in the Hopkins experiments. The sitters, too, speak of having been changed by the experience of witnessing these journeys, sometimes in surprising ways. Catherine McLean, who guided dozens of sessions during her time at Hopkins, told me, "I started out on the atheist side, but I began seeing things every day in my work that were at odds with this belief. My world became more and more mysterious as I sat with people on psilocybin." During my last interview with Richard Boothby, toward the end of a leisurely Sunday brunch at the Modern Art Museum in Baltimore, he looked at me with an expression that mixed an almost evangelical fervor about the treasures he had glimpsed at Hopkins with a measure of pity for his still hallucinogen-naive interlocutor. "I don't blame you for being envious." My encounters with the Hopkins volunteers had indeed left me feeling somewhat envious, but also with a great many more questions than answers. How are we to evaluate the insights these people bring back from their psychedelic journeys? What sort of authority should we grant them? Where in the world does the material that makes up these waking dreams, or as one volunteer put it, intra-psychic movies, come from? The unconscious? From the suggestions of their guides and the setting of the experiment? Or, as many of the volunteers believe, from somewhere out there or beyond? What do these mystical states of consciousness ultimately mean for our understanding of either the human mind or the universe? For his part, Roland Griffith's own encounters with the volunteers in the 2006 study reignited his passion for science, but they also left him with a deeper respect for all that science does not know, for what he is content to call the mysteries. For me, the data from those first sessions were, I don't want to use the word mind-blowing, but it was unprecedented the kinds of things we were seeing there in terms of the deep meaning and lasting spiritual significance of these effects. I've given lots of drugs to lots of people, and what you get are drug experiences. What's unique about psychedelics is the meaning that comes out of the experience. Yet, how real is that meaning? Griffiths himself is agnostic, but strikingly open-minded even about his volunteers' first-hand reports of a beyond, however they define it. "I'm willing to hold the possibility these experiences may or may not be true," he told me. "The exciting part is to use the tools we have to explore and pick apart this mystery." Not all of his colleagues share his open-mindedness. During one of our meetings over breakfast on the sun porch of his modest ranch house in suburban Baltimore, Griffiths mentioned a colleague at Hopkins, a prominent psychiatrist named Paul McHugh, who dismisses the psychedelic experience as nothing more than a form of toxic delirium. He encouraged me to Google McHugh. Quote, "Doctors encounter this strange and colorful state of mind in patients suffering from advanced hepatic, renal, or pulmonary disease in which toxic products accumulate in the body and do to the brain and mind just what LSD does," McHugh had written in a review of a book about the Harvard Psilocybin Project in Commentary magazine. "The vividness of color perception, the merging of physical sensations, the hallucinations, the disorientation and loss of a sense of time, the delusional joys and terrors that come and go, evoking unpredictable feelings and behaviors, are sadly familiar symptoms doctors are called to treat in hospitals every day." Griffiths admits it is possible that what he's seeing is some form of temporary psychosis, and he plans to test for delirium in an upcoming experiment. But he seriously doubts that diagnosis accurately describes what is going on with his volunteers. "Patients suffering from delirium find it really unpleasant," he points out, "and they certainly don't report months later, 'Wow, that was one of the greatest and most meaningful experiences of my life.'" William James grappled with these questions of veracity in his discussion on mystical states of consciousness. He concluded that the import of these experiences is and should be, quote, "authoritative over the individuals to whom they come, but that there is no reason the rest of us must, quote, accept their revelations uncritically." And yet he believed that the very possibility people can experience these states of consciousness should bear on our understanding of the mind and world. Quote, "The existence of mystical states absolutely overthrows the pretension of non-mystical states to be the sole and ultimate dictators of what we may believe. These alternate forms of consciousness might, in spite of all the perplexity, be indispensable stages in our approach to the final fullness of the truth." He detected in such experiences, in which the mind ascends to a more enveloping point of view, hints of a grand metaphysical reconciliation. Quote, "It is as if the opposites of the world, whose contradictoriness and conflict make all our difficulties and troubles, were melted into unity. This ultimate unity," he suspected, "was no mere delusion." Roland Griffiths today sounds like a scientist deeply committed, or rather recommitted, to his research. I described to you how, when I first got into meditation, I felt disconnected from my work life and considered dropping it entirely. I would say I'm now re-engaged in a way that's more integrated than it has ever been. I'm more interested in the final questions and existential truths, and with the sense of well-being, compassion, and love that come from these practices. Now I'm bringing these gifts to the laboratory, and it feels great. The idea that we can now approach mystical states of consciousness with the tools of science is what gets Roland Griffiths out of bed in the morning. Quote, "As a scientific phenomenon, if you can create a condition in which 70% of people will say they have had one of the most meaningful experiences of their lives, well, as a scientist, that's just incredible." For him, the import of the 2006 result is that it proved we can now do prospective studies of mystical states of consciousness because we can occasion them with a high degree of probability. That's the way science gains real traction. He believes the psilocybin work has opened a whole new frontier of human consciousness to scientific exploration. I describe myself as a kid in a candy shop. The gamble Roland Griffiths took with his career in 1998, when he decided to devote himself to the investigation of psychedelics and mystical experience, has already paid off. A month before our breakfast, Griffiths had received the Eddy Award from the College on Problems of Drug Dependence, perhaps the most prestigious lifetime achievement prize in the field. The nominators all cited Griffiths' psychedelic work as one of his signal contributions. The scope of that work has expanded significantly since the 2006 paper. When I last visited Hopkins in 2015, some 20 people were working on various studies involving psychedelics. Not since Spring Grove has there been such strong institutional support for the study of psychedelics, and never before has an institution of Hopkins' reputation devoted so many resources to what is, after all, the study of mystical states of consciousness. The Hopkins Lab remains keenly interested in exploring spirituality and the betterment of well people. There are trials underway giving psilocybin to long-term meditators and religious professionals, but the transformative effects of the mystical experience has obvious therapeutic implications that the lab has been investigating. Completed studies suggest that psilocybin, or rather the mystical state of consciousness that psilocybin occasions, may be useful in treating both addiction. A pilot study in smoking cessation achieved an 80% success rate, which is unprecedented, and the existential distress that often debilitates people facing a terminal diagnosis. When we last met, Griffiths was about to submit an article reporting striking results in the lab's trials using psilocybin to treat the anxiety and depression of cancer patients. The study found one of the largest treatment effects ever demonstrated for a psychiatric intervention. The majority of volunteers who had a mystical experience reported that their fear of death had either greatly diminished or completely disappeared. Once again, hard questions arise about the meaning and authority of such experiences, especially ones that appear to convince people that consciousness is not confined to brains and might somehow survive our deaths. Yet even to questions of this kind, Griffiths brings an open and curious mind. He says, "The phenomenology of these experiences is so profoundly reorganizing and profoundly compelling that I'm willing to hold there's a mystery here we can't understand." Griffiths has clearly traveled a long way from the strict behaviorism that once informed his scientific worldview. The experience of alternate states of consciousness, both his own and those of his volunteers, has opened him to possibilities about which few scientists will dare speak openly. "So what happens after you die?" he once asked me. "All I need is 1% of uncertainty. I can't think of anything more interesting than what I may or may not discover at the time I die. That's the most interesting question going." For that reason, he fervently hopes he isn't hit by a bus, but rather has enough time to savor the experience without the distraction of pain. Western materialism says the switch gets turned off and that's it. But there are so many other descriptions. It could be a beginning. Wouldn't that be amazing? This is when Griffiths turned the tables and started asking me about my own spiritual outlook, questions for which I was completely unprepared. "How sure are you there is nothing after death?" he asked. I demurred, but he persisted. "What do you think the chances are that there is something beyond death, in percentages?" "Oh, I don't know," I stammered. 2 or 3%? To this day, I have no idea where that estimate came from, but Griffiths seized on it. "That's a lot," he said. So I turned the tables back again, put the question to him. "I don't know if I want to answer it," he said with a laugh, glancing at my tape recorder. "It depends on which hat I'm wearing." Roland Griffiths had more than one hat. I only had one, I realized, and that made me feel a little jealous. Compared with many scientists, or for that matter, many spiritual types, Roland Griffiths possesses a large measure of what Keats, referring to Shakespeare, described as negative capability, the ability to exist amid uncertainties, mysteries, and doubt without reaching for absolutes, whether those of science or spirituality. It makes no more sense to say I'm 100% convinced of a material worldview than to say I'm 100% convinced of the literal version of the Bible. At our last meeting, a dinner at a bistro in his Baltimore neighborhood, I tried to engage Griffiths in a discussion of the ostensible conflict between science and spirituality. I asked him if he agreed with E.O. Wilson, who has written that all of us must ultimately choose either the path of science or the path of spirituality. But Griffiths doesn't see the two ways of knowing as mutually exclusive and has little patience for absolutists on either side of the supposed divide. Rather, he hopes the two ways can inform each other and correct each other's defects, and in that exchange help us to pose and then possibly answer the big questions we face. I then read to him a letter from Houston Smith, the scholar of comparative religion, who in 1962 had volunteered in Walter Pankey's Good Friday experiment. It was written to Bob Jesse shortly after the publication of Griffith's landmark 2006 paper. Jesse had shared it with me. Quote, "The Johns Hopkins experiment proves that under controlled experimental conditions, psilocybin can occasion genuine mystical experiences. It uses science, which modernity trusts, to undermine modernity's secularism. In doing so, it offers hope of nothing less than a resacralization of the natural and social world, a spiritual revival that is our best defense against not only soullessness, but against religious fanaticism. And it does so in the very teeth of the unscientific prejudices built into our current drug laws." As I read Smith's letter aloud, a smile bloomed across Griffith's face. He was clearly moved, but had little to add except to say, "That's beautiful." Chapter 2. Natural History. Be Mushroomed. At the end of my first meeting with Roland Griffiths, the session in his Johns Hopkins office where he engaged me on the topics of his own mystical experience, my assessment of the odds of an afterlife, and the potential of psilocybin to change people's lives, the scientist stood up from his desk, unfolding his lanky frame, and reached into the pocket of his trousers to take out a small medallion. "A little gift for you," he explained, "but first you must answer a question." "At this moment," Griffiths began, locking me in firm eye contact, "are you aware that you are aware?" Perplexed, I thought for a long, self-conscious moment and then replied in the affirmative. This must have been the correct answer because Griffiths handed me the coin. On one side was a quartet of tall, slender, curving Psilocybe cubensis, one of the more common species of magic mushroom. On the back was a quotation from William Blake that, it occurred to me later, neatly aligned the way of the scientist with that of the mystic. The true method of knowledge is experiment. It seems that the previous summer, Roland Griffiths had gone for the first time to Burning Man. Had I heard of it? And when he learned that no money is exchanged in the temporary city, only gifts, he had the mushroom medallions minted so he would have something suitable to give away or trade. Now he gives the coins to volunteers in the research program as a parting gift. Griffiths had surprised me once again. Or twice. First, that the scientist had attended the Arts and Psychedelics Festival in the Nevada desert. And second, that he had seen fit in choosing his gift to honor the psilocybin mushroom itself. On one level, a mushroom medallion made perfect sense. The molecule that Griffiths and his colleagues have been working with for the last 15 years does, after all, come from a fungus. Both the mushroom and its psychoactive compound were unknown to science until the 1950s, when the psilocybin mushroom was discovered in southern Mexico, where Mazatec Indians had been using the flesh of the gods in secret for healing and divination since before the Spanish conquest. Yet apart from the decorative ceramic mushrooms on the shelf in the session room, there are few, if any, reminders of magic mushrooms in the lab. No one I spoke to at Hopkins ever mentioned the rather astonishing fact that the life-changing experiences their volunteers were reporting owed to the action of a chemical compound found in nature, in a mushroom. In the laboratory context, it can be easy to lose sight of this astonishment. All of the scientists doing psychedelic research today work exclusively with a synthetic version of the psilocybin molecule. The mushroom's psychoactive compound was first identified, synthesized, and named in the late 1950s by Albert Hofmann, the Swiss chemist who discovered LSD. So the volunteers ingest a little white pill made in a lab rather than a handful of gnarly and acrid-tasting mushrooms. Their journeys unfold in a landscape of medical suites populated, figuratively speaking, by men and women in white coats. I suppose this is the usual distancing effect of modern science at work, but here it is compounded by a specific desire to distance psilocybin from its tangled roots, or I should say mycelia, in the worlds of 1960s counterculture, Native American shamanism, and perhaps nature itself. For it is there, in nature, that we bump up against the mystery of a little brown mushroom with the power to change the consciousness of the animals that eat it. LSD, too, it is easy to forget, was derived from a fungus, Claviceps purpurea, or ergot. Somehow, for some reason, these remarkable mushrooms produce, in addition to spores, meanings in human minds. In the course of my days spent hanging around the Hopkins lab and hours spent interviewing people about their psilocybin journeys, I became increasingly curious to explore this other territory, that is the natural history of these mushrooms and their strange powers. Where did these mushrooms grow and how? Why did they evolve the ability to produce a chemical compound so closely related to serotonin, the neurotransmitter, that it can slip across the blood-brain barrier and temporarily take charge of the mammalian brain? Was it a defense chemical intended to poison mushroom eaters? That would seem to be the most straightforward explanation, yet it is undermined by the fact that the fungus produces the hallucinogen almost exclusively in its fruiting body, that part of the organism it is happiest to have eaten. Was there perhaps some benefit to the mushroom in being able to change the minds of the animals that eat it? A note about mushrooms. Technically, a mushroom is the fruiting body of a fungus, its reproductive organ. Think of mushrooms as the apples on a tree that grows entirely underground. Most of the fungal organism exists below ground in the form of mycelia, the typically white, cobwebby, single-cell-wide filaments that extend through the soil. But because it is hard to observe and study these delicate subterranean structures, they can't be unearthed without breaking, we tend to focus on the mushrooms we can see, even though they are just the tip of a kind of fungal iceberg. There were also the more philosophical questions posed by the existence of a fungus that could not only change consciousness, but occasion a profound mystical experience in humans. This fact can be interpreted in two completely different ways. On the first interpretation, the mind-altering power of psilocybin argues for a firmly materialist understanding of consciousness and spirituality, because the changes observed in the mind can be traced directly to the presence of a chemical, psilocybin. What is more material than a chemical? One could reasonably conclude from the action of psychedelics that the gods are nothing more than chemically induced figments of the hominid imagination. Yet, surprisingly, most of the people who have had these experiences don't see the matter that way at all. Even the most secular among them come away from their journeys convinced there exists something that transcends a material understanding of reality, some sort of a beyond. It's not that they deny a naturalistic basis for this revelation, they just interpret it differently. If the experience of transcendence is mediated by molecules that flow through both our brains and the natural world of plants and fungi, then perhaps nature is not as mute as science has told us, and spirit, however defined, exists out there, is immanent in nature, in other words, just as countless pre-modern cultures have believed. What to my spiritually impoverished mind seemed to constitute a good case for the disenchantment of the world becomes in the minds of the more psychedelically experienced irrefutable proof of its fundamental enchantment, flesh of the gods indeed. So here was a curious paradox. The same phenomenon that pointed to a materialist explanation for spiritual and religious belief gave people an experience so powerful it convinced them of the existence of a non-material reality, the very basis of religious belief. I hoped that getting to know the psychoactive LBMs, mycologist shorthand for little brown mushrooms, at the bottom of this paradox might clarify the matter or perhaps somehow dissolve it. I was already something of a mushroom hunter, secure in my ability to identify a handful of edible woodland species, chanterelles, morels, black trumpets, and porcini, with a high enough degree of confidence to eat what I found. However, I had been told by all my teachers that the world of LBMs was far more daunting in its complexity and peril. Many, if not most, of the species that can kill you are LBMs. But perhaps with some expert guidance, I could add a psilocybe or two to my mushroom hunting repertoire, and in the process begin to unpack the mystery of their existence and spooky powers. There was never any doubt who could best help me on this quest, assuming he was willing. Paul Stamets, a mycologist from Washington State who literally wrote the book on the genus psilocybe in the form of the authoritative 1996 field guide, Psilocybin Mushrooms of the World. Stamets has himself published, that is, identified and described in a peer-reviewed journal, four new species of psilocybe, including Azurescence, named for his son Azurius, and the most potent species yet known. Complicating matters, Stamets first named his son for the bluish color that psilocybes turn, then named the bluest of the psilocybes after his son. But while Stamets is one of the country's most respected mycologists, he works entirely outside the academy, has no graduate degree, funds most of his own research, and holds views of the role of fungi in nature that are well outside the scientific mainstream and that, he will gladly tell you, owe to insights granted to him by the mushrooms themselves in the course of both close study and regular ingestion. I've known Stamets for years, though not very well, and always, from what I confess, has been a somewhat skeptical distance. His extravagant claims for the powers of mushrooms and eyebrow-elevating boasts about his mushroom work with institutions like DARPA, the Pentagon's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and NIH, the National Institutes of Health, are bound to set off a journalist's bullshit detector, rightly or, as often happens in his case, wrongly. Over the years, we found ourselves at some of the same conferences, so I've had several opportunities to hear his talks, which consists of a beguiling, often brilliant mashup of hard science and visionary speculation, with the line between the two often impossible to discern. His 2008 TED Talk, which is representative, has been viewed online more than 4 million times. Stamets, who was born in 1955 in Salem, Ohio, is a big hairy man with a beard and a bearish mien. I was not surprised to learn he once worked as a lumberjack in the Pacific Northwest. On stage, he usually wears what appears to be a felt hat in the Alpine style, but which, as he'll explain, is in fact made in Transylvania from something called amadou, the spongy inner layer of the horse's hoof fungus, Fomus fomentarius, a polypore that grows on several species of dead or dying trees. Amadou is flammable and in ancient times was used to start and transport fires. Ötzi, the 5,000-year-old Iceman found mummified in an alpine glacier in 1991, was carrying a pouch in which he had a piece of amadou. Because of its antimicrobial properties, Fomus fomentarius was also used to dress wounds and preserve food. Stamets is so deep into the world of fungi, there's frequently one perched on top of his head. Fungi constitute the most poorly understood and underappreciated kingdom of life on Earth. Though indispensable to the health of the planet, as recyclers of organic matter and builders of soil, they are the victims not only of our disregard, but of a deep-seated ill will, a mycophobia that Stamets deems a form of biological racism. Leaving aside their reputation for poisoning us, this is surprising in that we are closer, genetically speaking, to the fungal kingdom than to that of the plants. Like us, they live off the energy that plants harvest from the sun. Stamets has made it his life's work to right this wrong by speaking out on their behalf and by demonstrating the potential of mushrooms to solve a great many of the world's problems. Indeed, the title of his most popular lecture and the subtitle of his 2005 book, Mycelium Running, is How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. By the end of his presentation, this claim no longer sounds hyperbolic. I can remember the first time I heard Stamets talk about mycoremediation, his term for the use of mushrooms to clean up pollution and industrial waste. One of the jobs of fungi in nature is to break down complex organic molecules. Without them, the Earth would long ago have become a vast, uninhabitable waste heap of dead but undecomposed plants and animals. So after the Exxon Valdez ran aground off the coast of Alaska in 1989, spilling millions of gallons of crude oil into Prince William Sound, Stamets revived a long-standing idea of putting fungi to work breaking down petrochemical waste. He showed a slide of a steaming heap of oily black sludge before inoculating it with the spores of oyster mushrooms, and then a second photograph of the same pile taken 4 weeks later, when it was reduced by a third and covered in a thick mantle of snowy white oyster mushrooms. It was a performance and a feat of alchemy I won't soon forget. But Stamets's aspirations for the fungal kingdom go well beyond turning petrochemical sludge into arable soil. Indeed, in his view, there is scarcely an ecological or medical problem that mushrooms can't help solve. Cancer? Stamets's extract of turkey tail mushrooms, Tramites versicolor, has been shown to help cancer patients by stimulating their immune systems. Stamets claims to have used it to help cure his mother's stage 4 breast cancer. Bioterrorism? After 9/11, the federal government's BioShield program asked to screen hundreds of the rare mushroom strains in Stamets' collection and found several that showed strong activity against SARS, smallpox, herpes, and bird and swine flu. If this strikes you as implausible, remember that penicillin is the product of a fungus. Colony collapse disorder? After watching honeybees visiting a woodpile to nibble on mycelium, Stamets identified several species of fungus that bolster the bees' resistance to infection and CCD. Insect infestation? A few years ago, Stamets won a patent for a mycopesticide, a mutant mycelium from a species of cordyceps that, after being eaten by carpenter ants, colonizes their bodies and kills them, but not before chemically inducing the ant to climb to the highest point in its environment and then bursting a mushroom from the top of its head that releases its spores to the wind. The second or third time I watched Stamets show a video of a cordyceps doing its diabolical thing to an ant, commandeering its body, making it do its bidding, and then exploding a mushroom from its brain in order to disseminate its genes, it occurred to me that Stamets and that poor ant had rather a lot in common. Fungi haven't killed him, it's true, and he probably knows enough about their wiles to head off that fate. But it's also true that this man's life, his brain, has been utterly taken over by fungi. He has dedicated himself to their cause, speaking for the mushrooms in the same way that Dr. Seuss's Lorax speaks for the trees. He disseminates fungal spores far and wide, helping them, whether by mail order or sheer dint of his enthusiasm, to vastly expand their range and spread their message. I don't think I'm saying anything about Paul Stamets to which he would object. He writes in his book that mycelia, the vast cobwebby whitish net of single-celled filaments called hyphae with which fungi weave their way through the soil, are intelligent, forming a sentient membrane and the neurological network of nature. The title of his book, Mycelium Running, can be read in two ways. The mycelium is indeed always running through the ground, where it plays a critical role in forming soils, keeping plants and animals in good health, and knitting together the forest. But the mycelium are also, in Stamets' view, running the show, that of nature in general, and, like a neural software program, the minds of certain creatures, including, he would be the first to tell you, Paul Stamets himself. "Mushrooms are bringing us a message from nature," he likes to say. "This is a call I'm hearing." Yet even some of Stamets's airier notions turn out to have a scientific foundation beneath them. For years now, Stamets has been talking about the vast web of mycelia in the soil as Earth's natural internet, a redundant, complexly branched, self-repairing, and scalable communications network linking many species over tremendous distances. The biggest organism on Earth is not a whale or a tree, but a mushroom, a honey fungus in Oregon that is 2.4 miles wide. Stamets contends that these mycelial networks are in some sense conscious, aware of their environment and able to respond to challenges accordingly. When I first heard these ideas, I thought they were, at best, fanciful metaphors. Yet, in the years since, I've watched as a growing body of scientific research has emerged to suggest they are much more than metaphors. Experiments with slime molds have demonstrated these organisms can navigate mazes in search of food, sensing its location and then growing in that direction. The mycelia in a forest do link the trees in it, root to root, not only supplying them with nutrients, but serving as a medium that conveys information about environmental threats and allows trees to selectively send nutrients to other trees in the forest. A forest is a far more complex, sociable, and intelligent entity than we knew, and it is fungi that organize the arboreal society. Stamets's ideas and theories have turned out to be far more durable and practicable than I ever would have guessed. This was the other reason I became eager to spend some time with Stamets. I was curious to find out how his own experience with psilocybin had colored his thinking and life work. Yet I wasn't at all certain he would be willing to talk on the record about psilocybin, much less take me shroom hunting, now that he had a successful business, had 8 or 9 patents to his name, and was collaborating with institutions like DARPA and NIH and the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. In the more recent interviews and lectures I could find online, he seldom talked about psilocybin and often omitted mention of the field guide from his list of publications. What's more, he had just received prestigious honors from the Mycological Society of America and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS. Paul Stamets, it seemed, had gone legit. Bad timing for me. Thankfully, I was wrong. When I reached Stamets at his home in Comilche, Washington, and told him what I was up to, he couldn't have been more forthcoming or cooperative. We talked for a long time about psilocybin mushrooms, and it soon became clear they remained a subject of keen interest to him. He knew all about the work going on at Hopkins, in fact had consulted with the Hopkins team when they were first looking for a source of psilocybin. My impression was that the revival of legitimate university research had made Stamets more comfortable reopening this particular chapter in his life. He mentioned he was in the process of updating the 1996 psilocybin field guide. The only discordant note in the conversation came when I casually dropped the slang expression for psilocybin when asking him about going hunting for shrooms. "I really, really hate that word," he said, almost gravely, adopting the tone of a parent upbraiding a potty-mouthed child. The word never crossed my lips again. By the end of the call, Stamets had invited me up to his place in Washington State on the little Skookum Inlet at the base of the Olympic Peninsula. I asked him gingerly if I could come at a time when the psilocybes were fruiting. "Most of them have already come and gone," he said, "but if you come right after Thanksgiving and the weather's right, I can take you to the only place in the world where psilocybe azurescence has been consistently found, at the mouth of the Columbia River." He mentioned the name of the park